This episode is brought to you by VPP Simplified. Now you can get element by element tracking and guidance for your VPP journey. Every aspect of the VPP requirements in one easy to use interactive spreadsheet. It explains every sub element in detail, contains an easy to read stoplight so you can track current status for each sub element. It provides you with a three-step verification for completion of each sub-element. There's even a notes section for you to compile language that will eventually be used for your VPP application. It even comes complete with graphs to show current state and track your progress moving forward. Look, achieving VPP star status can be tough, but understanding what it takes to get there can be simplified. This VPP gap tool will help you do that. Go to vppsimplified.com for more information.
Welcome to the Safety Pro Podcast, where we help you manage workplace safety one episode at a time. And now, your very own safety pro, Blaine J. Hoffman.
Welcome to another episode of the Safety Pro Podcast. Today, we are going to talk about emergency exit routes, or routes. Is it routes or routes? Depends on where you're from. So, we're going to get into this topic. We're going to define what it is. We're going to talk about how many you got to have. We're going to get into some, you know, design and construction requirements. We're going to get into all kinds of good stuff, all centered around emergency exit routes, routes. So, what is an exit route? An exit route is nothing more than a continuous, that's important, continuous and unobstructed path of exit travel from any point within a workplace to a place of safety. An exit route consists of three parts. These three parts are what you're going to focus on in your workplace. One, the exit access. This is the portion of an exit route that leads to the exit. So accessing the exit. Then you have number two, the actual exit, or what we often call the exit way. That's the portion of the exit route that is generally separated from other areas to provide a protected way of travel to the exit discharge, which is number three, exit discharge. So the exit way is sort of the opening, the doorway you walk through to get to the third element of an exit route, which is the exit discharge. That's the part of the exit route that leads directly outside or to a street, a walkway, you know, any kind of refuge area, muster point, the public way, or any other open space with access to the outside that leads to safety. Okay, so an exit discharge, a bad exit discharge, would be one that exits into an alley that has a dead end. There's no way out. It's just like a courtyard in there. You're blocked in by four walls. That's not an exit discharge. Now let's talk about how many you have to have. Normally, a workplace has to have at least two exit routes to permit prompt evacuation of employees and other building occupants during an emergency. More than two exits are required, however, if the number of employees, the size of the building, or just the arrangement of the workplace won't allow employees to evacuate safely. Now, keep in mind, exit routes, they have to be located as far away as practical from each other in case one is blocked by fire or smoke or another type of emergency requiring people to get out. There is an exception. If the number of employees, the size of the building, its occupancy, or the arrangement of the workplace allows all employees to evacuate safely during an emergency, one exit route is typically permitted under this exemption. But remember, this is OSHA. Pop quiz, what else do we have to consider when we're talking about the adequate number of exit routes in our facility? The local authority having jurisdiction. So your local building codes, state, city, village, township, municipality. So they may drive something different than what we're talking about in this case, OSHA. So what are some of the design and construction requirements for exit routes? Well, they have to be permanent parts of the workplace. So they have to be a permanent part of the facility, the building. The exit discharge, as I said earlier, has to lead directly outside or to a street, walkway, refuge area, public way, or any kind of open space that has access to the outside. Now, these areas, they have to be large enough to accommodate the building occupants likely to use that exit route. So it's got to also be large enough to facilitate the safe discharge into that public way or open area, the number of people likely to go out that building. Now, the problem I have with this is, well, you don't really know where the fire is going to be or the emergency is going to be inside a building. You may be driving 70% of the building occupants to one exit. So who's to determine how many are likely to go out of there? That always bothered me of, you know, how are you going to anticipate the likely number of people involved in an emergency? I mean, then it's not really an emergency, you know, or an incident, right? An unplanned event. Sounds like it's planned if you're like, well, if a fire happens right here, these people go this way and those people go that way. Never works out that way in my experience, especially as a firefighter. You know, folks go out whatever building. Sometimes people go out the nearest exit, and oftentimes folks go out the exit they're familiar with. They'll go right through a building, all the way through the building to the front, because that's where they parked or that's the door they always go through. You know, they just got caught off guard in a meeting in a conference room in a different part of the building. They oftentimes won't go to the nearest exit. So that's kind of fuzzy. All you have to do is you make sure that all the exit discharges that you have in your facility, that they're free of obstruction, they won't entrap somebody once they're outside, they're large enough and kept and maintained, whether it's, you know, landscaping, cut back, and all that good stuff, large enough to get folks out. The exit stairs, if you have them, that continue beyond the level on which the exit discharge is located, has to be interrupted at that level by doors, partitions, or other effective means that clearly indicate the direction of travel leading to the exit discharge. So going down a flight of stairs and then having to turn. So, you know, like I said, if it's got to be interrupted at that level by doors, partitions, or other effective means that indicate the direction of travel leading to the exit discharge. Exit route doors, they got to be unlocked from the inside. They must be free of devices or alarms that could restrict use of the exit route if the device or alarm fails. That's key. You can put an alarm on a door with a sign that says emergency exit only, alarm will sound. But if the alarm malfunctions, it, you know, engages a lock to prevent people from going out, can't do that. So it has to be unlocked from the inside. Panic bar, push bars, whatever you want to call them, are pretty common in this case. Side hinged exit doors have to be used to connect rooms to exit routes. These doors must swing out in the direction of exit travel if the room is to be occupied by more than 50 people or if it's a high hazard area. So the door has to push out. Also, your local authority having jurisdiction will drive some of this. They may indicate that it's 25 people, an occupancy limit of 25, and that door has to be present. Now, I've talked to a lot of folks that talk about, gosh, classroom design, schools. We're talking about public buildings now, public schools. Why the doors open into the hallway? It's stupid. You open a door right into the hallway when kids are walking by. Well, this is why. Because the number of kids and occupants in that room, you don't want a bottleneck or log jam at the door in an emergency trying to get out. The door has to open out. That's why. So that might be the case in some of your meeting rooms. It might not. You may be in a building that doesn't get inspected very frequently, and you've got, you know, 45 people in a conference room, a large boardroom or conference room for training, and you may have doors that open in, and, you know, look for that. Exit routes must support the maximum permitted occupant load for each floor served, and the capacity of an exit route may not decrease in the direction of exit route travel to the exit discharge. So you don't want to create a taper or an aisle or hallway that gets narrower as you head towards the exit. You can't do that. Again, a bottleneck or a funnel would be the issue there. So I talk to folks in general industry all the time about this one. And it comes up when you maintain a 36-inch wide aisle. And then when you get like within 5-6 feet of the exit doorway, the exit discharge, the exit way, I should say, they then taper it down. Well, you can't do that if it's a continuous aisle towards that door. You have to maintain that uniform width all the way up to the door. Here in a few, I'll mention something that OSHA calls out in the size of the exit way. That's why folks get into some trouble there and they scratch their heads on this one. Ceilings of exit routes must be at least 7 feet 6 inches high. Again, check your local building codes. And this is the one I was talking about. An exit access has to be at least, that means the minimum, 28 inches wide at all points. Where there is only one access or exit access leading to an exit or exit discharge, the width of the exit and the exit discharge must be at least equal to the width of the exit access. So that 36-inch aisle going up to the exit access, you have to maintain that, the exit way, the doorway, and the exit discharge. So if you have a 36-inch aisle, and that's the only exit access leading to an exit, you have to maintain that doorway. So you can't put a 28-inch door on that door frame. You have to maintain a 36-inch door. But again, this is OSHA. Check your local building codes. Outdoor exit routes are permitted, but must meet the minimum height and width requirements for indoor exit routes. And they must have guardrails to protect unenclosed sides if a fall hazard exists. We see this on ramps, dock ramps going out, where you know the elevation or the angle, the pitch is such that requires a guardrail or a handrail, and so oftentimes we won't find one. They have to be, if they're covered with snow or ice, even if it's likely to accumulate, you have to cover that walkway, or, and this is key, unless the employer can demonstrate accumulations will be removed before a slipping hazard exists. Good luck with that one. Especially if you're in the Midwest like me, you know, Ohio, you could pretty much cover all four seasons in one afternoon. But, you know, a lot of folks aren't real good at getting out there as soon as the ice and snow event occurs and making sure the slip hazard is prevented. As soon as it hits the ground, one could argue the slip hazard has been created, because at any time somebody can go out that door. So, you know, putting canopies going out 5-10 feet on, you know, from an exit discharge, that's probably what you want to look at. Not real feasible for some older buildings with a lot of exits and exit doors. It could get expensive. So we're left with having to, you know, with a high maintenance regimen for these, you know, especially in inclement weather and seasons, for maintaining these exit discharge. Also, outdoor exit routes have to be reasonably straight and have smooth, solid, substantially level walkways. Reasonably straight, I like that one. And cannot have a dead end longer than 20 feet. All right, so the exit, as far as exit requirements, they have to be separated by fire-resistant materials. That is, 1 hour fire resistance rating if the exit connects 3 or fewer stories, and 2 hour fire resistance rating if the exit connects more than 3 floors. Again, local building codes are going to vary on this one as well, but remember, they're always going to go stricter and not more lenient than this. Exits are permitted to only have those openings necessary to allow access to the exit from occupied areas in the workplace or to the exit discharge. Now, the openings, they got to be protected by like self-closing or approved fire doors that remain closed or automatically close in an emergency. They have to be self-closing or remain closed during an emergency after you go out. Talking about getting outside, and once you're outside, it's a great time to stop and talk about our partners in safety, the first of which is who's on location. Safety and security starts with knowing who is on site. And that's why you need to know who's on location. Who'sonlocation.com handles visitor management, contractor management, employee attendance, and one of my favorite topics, evacuation management. The evacuation management web app, it helps you get your people safe, give first responders critical information about who cannot be accounted for before they put their lives at risk. This web app is available for iOS, Microsoft devices, Android, and these are all both phone and tablets. Again, it's a web application, so you know it's going to be compatible with any device that you have. You can roll call employees, even visitors and contractors. They can swipe their name from the present on-site list when they are safe using the same web app. You can send everyone on-site a request via text to confirm that they're in a safe location with just a few clicks. When they reply with the word safe, they are automatically removed from the list of people you still need to verify. And, get this, if someone replies with anything other than the word safe, it is relayed to all app users in case someone is nearby and able to safely render assistance. I'm trialing this right now as well, along with everybody else. So I'm telling you right now, this is a fantastic app. If you're using a clipboard, paper, and a bullhorn and roster, you know, that's crazy. We all have our phones on us. Somebody always has a phone on them. You know, have this, download this, you know, log in, pin the web app to your home screen like I did. Tap that icon when you get outside. Choose the location if you have multiple locations. And then, bam, your roster pulls up. You can set all of this up in minutes. It's really easy to do. Check it out for yourself. You won't be disappointed. Get a 30-day free trial by going to whosonlocation.com. You're going to get access to all features and add-ons. There's no credit card required. Again, whosonlocation.com. Grab a 30-day free trial today. All this talk about marking aisles, exit routes, and exit discharges and all that stuff, you know, it's a perfect time to also mention Mighty Line Floor Tape. That's right, the official floor marking floor sign company of the Safety Pro podcast. And this is why they're such a powerful partner in safety. Okay, they can help you maintain your facilities. They know how important safety is to your organization. And just looking at the breadth of the Mighty Line product line, I mean, you can tell it covers everything you need to implement a 5S system for the increased productivity of your facility and the safety of your workers. Mighty Line Reflective or Glow Tape can create a safer facility for you during emergencies and power outages and low light conditions, facilitate folks getting out in the event of an emergency. The Glow Center Line can be critical during power outages and make forklift driving even safer as well. Just listen to some of these facts. Their patented technology makes their floor tape more durable than others because it is 7 times thicker than the average floor tape. The beveled edge increases durability for forklift traffic. The peel and stick adhesive removes easily, and it's all made right here in the USA. Don't take my word for it. Grab a free sample of Mighty Line floor tape. Go to mightylinetape.com/podcast. Grab a free sample today. And while you're there, check out past episodes of the Safety Pro podcast. Again, mightylinetape.com/podcast. Get a free sample. All right, so let's get into maintenance, safeguarding, and operational features for exit routes. So the OSHA standards require, you know, a lot of little things be in place, right? So you have to do some of the following. Keep exit routes free of explosive or highly flammable furnishings and other decorations. This one I've seen. I've caught this one during audits, okay? A manufacturing site will have strapped or chained, you know, acetylene tanks or something like that, propane tanks right next to, like 2 feet from an exit that's got the exit sign right above the door, and that's where they store those tanks. That would fall into this, you know, category right here. Also, arrange exit routes so employees will not have to travel toward a high hazard area unless the path of travel is effectively shielded from the high hazard area. Ensure that exit routes are unobstructed, such as by materials, equipment, locked doors, dead-end corridors. Don't create a rat maze for your people to figure out how to get out of this place, okay? You know, look for these things when you do your next audit. See if you can meet this standard. Ensure that safeguards designed to protect employees during an emergency remain in good working order. Lights, okay? Emergency lights. You got to test those. That's just an example, which leads to the next point. Provide lighting. I mean, you have to have them. And the building codes are going to drive a lot of this. Your local fire marshal will come in and say you need, you know, this number of emergency lights with the battery backup unless you have a generator. And the generator's got to kick on when so many seconds. There's a lot of little rules and things you got to follow for some of this stuff. Keep exit route doors free of decorations or signs that obscure the visibility of exit route doors. During the holidays, don't wrap an exit route door in like wrapping paper because it's cute and then the wall on either side of it's wrapped, it kind of blends in. It's got to be a door. It's got to be clear that it's a doorway. Post signs along the exit access indicating the direction of travel to the nearest exit and exit discharge if that direction is not immediately apparent. Also, the line of sight to an exit must be clearly visible at all times. This one's a good one too. You can catch this one in many facilities. You stand in the middle of a shop floor and you just start looking around. Do a 360. I'm turning my head here. You'll probably hear my voice fade, but like you can see me, right? You know, just start doing a 360 and start looking around and looking up, because you're going to, if you're in the middle of most shop floors and manufacturing environments, your view is going to be obstructed by machines, equipment, panels, you know, stuff like that. It's going to be obstructed. So you need to make sure you locate signs up high enough where people can look up and see the exit sign lit and move toward that direction. Mark doors or passages along an exit access that could be mistaken for an exit. You do this by putting a sign that says, get this one, not an exit. Or you can use another sign like closet, mechanical room, something like that. So like every door, if all your doors look the same in your facility, every door doesn't have to have the not an exit. You can actually mark it with, you know, janitor closet, utility room, pump room, stuff like that. You know, you can have it either way. You got to maintain fire retardant paints or solutions to ensure that they maintain their properties. So if you have any kind of treatment on walls, you know, when you fall into this category of we've provided effective barriers from hazardous areas that people can walk through, you got to maintain those areas. So have a good maintenance regimen around anything like that you may have in your facilities. Also, during any kind of construction, alteration or repairs, you know, moving out a cell and doing a new cell layout in a work area, and you're moving equipment and displacing equipment, and you now have just covered up three aisles that normally people use, you've got to provide highly visible alternate means of paths of travel, I should say. And you should educate everybody on what's going to take place before you actually do it. So one morning people walk in and just stand there and go, oh, wow, everything's in my way. And they have to go look for the alternate route. Provide an emergency alarm system to alert employees unless employees can properly see or smell a fire or other hazard in time to provide adequate warning to them. Yeah, right. This is, if you're in a manufacturing environment, it's loud, you know, it's noisy, you know, you can't really see a whole lot outside of your work cell just because of the size and configuration of a lot of these machines and the way they're placed. So, you know, you've got to have an audible and visual alarm system. Strobes, an audible alarm, either a noise, like a tone, or a lot of modern systems have an audible voice prompt that says a fire has been detected, please evacuate safely, something like that. So that gets me to, you know, how do we wrap all this stuff up into a written program, right? Are you even required to have an emergency action plan? Well, yeah. Well, sort of. Now, small employers get out of a lot of this stuff, right? Because they only have a few employees, and that's fewer than 10, by the way. 10 or fewer, I should say. You can communicate what you expect your employees to do verbally in an orientation or a meeting. You can just tell them, hey, guys, you see or smell something funny, or somebody starts yelling fire, just go out the nearest two exits or whatever. If you got 10 or fewer employees, your facility is probably not that big. So you are allowed to do that according to the OSHA standard, okay? However, if you have more than 10 employees, your plan, your emergency evacuation plan, it's got to be written. It's got to be a manual, right? It's got to be kept in the workplace and available for employees to review. Now, you are required to have an emergency action plan only when the applicable OSHA standard requires it. So I'll give you some examples, but OSHA strongly recommends that all employers have an emergency action plan or EAP, right? So which OSHA standards explicitly require an emergency action plan be written? 1910.119, that's process safety management of highly hazardous chemicals. 1910.160 fixed extinguishing systems require a written, if you have those, it requires a written emergency action plan. 1910.164 fire detection systems. If you've been required to install a detection system because of some process that you have, then bam, it's going to trigger an EAP. 1910.272, good old grain handling. You're going to need to put an EAP together for that as well. Ethylene oxide, 1910.1047, you're going to be required to produce an EAP as well. You know, those are just a few examples of the OSHA standard that actually say, hey, not only do you have to do these things related to this unique hazard, but you also need to formalize an emergency action plan in writing, communicate it, make it available on site, all that good stuff, okay? So what has to go in the EAP? What are some of the minimum, you know, elements, if you will, that need to be included? One, procedures for reporting fires and other emergencies. You got to spell that out, how you expect people to respond. Two, procedures for emergency evacuation. This includes the type of the evacuation and the exit route assignments. Number three, procedures for employees who stay behind to continue critical plant operations. This sounds crazy, but to those of us who've been in manufacturing for, you know, a number of years, you'll often find that maintenance stays behind or either inside or out in some cases, depending upon the emergency. And you really got to have a lot of faith and trust in your employees to make rational decisions. And you really need to size up the scene and take into consideration the nature of the hazard or the emergency. But you'll often find that you have to, you know, kick on an emergency generator, turn off a valve here or there so that we don't have gases going into the atmosphere, stuff like that. So you'll often find contingency plans for limited number of personnel that have to do some emergency shutdown procedures or processes before they can get out, or we could be talking about a catastrophic event. Four, procedures to account for all employees after the evacuation. Check out whosonlocation.com. Great partner in safety. It works. So you can actually satisfy that with something like that, you know, getting into a digital type of, you know, evacuation management process. But you need a procedure, and you have to spell it out in your emergency action plan, to account for employees after the evacuation. Five, you need procedures for employees performing rescue or medical duties. Six, you need the name or job title. I like that one, especially if you have high turnover or people move on, people take other jobs. So have the job title of the employees to contact for detailed plan information. And lastly, an alarm system to alert workers. You have to talk about what's involved in that. If you have a wavering alarm or a solid tone for fire, wavering alarm for, you know, weather, you have to describe the alarm system. It has to be included in your emergency action plan. In addition, you must designate and train employees to assist in a safe and orderly evacuation of other employees. You must review the emergency action plan with each employee that's covered when any of the following occurs. A, the plan is developed initially, or an employee is assigned initially to one of those roles. You have to cover that with them. B, employees' responsibilities under the plan changes. You got to cover that with them. And C, if you change the entire plan altogether, you've got to cover it with them. That's a no-brainer. But, you know, those are the three times that you would have to go over with individuals named in the plan, you know, what's required of them. So let's talk about fire prevention in general. We talked about emergency action plans, all sorts of emergency. Now let's focus a little more narrow scope here. Fire prevention plans. Again, same deal here. If you have 10 or fewer employees, you can communicate this plan verbally to the workforce. Otherwise, if you have more than 10 employees, your plan has to be written, kept on site, available for everyone to review, the same deal. So a fire prevention plan has to have certain elements. One, it has to list all major fire hazards, proper handling and storage procedures for hazardous materials, potential ignition sources, and their control. and the type of fire protection equipment necessary to control each major hazard. 2. It has to contain the procedures to control accumulation of flammable and combustible waste materials, so housekeeping protocols would be common here. 3. Has to have procedures for regular maintenance of safeguards installed on heat-producing equipment to prevent the accidental ignition of combustible materials. 4. The name, or my favorite, the job title, of employees responsible for maintaining equipment to prevent or control sources of ignition or fires. And 5. The name or job title of employees responsible for the control of fuel source hazards. In addition, when you assign employees to a job, you have to inform them of any fire hazards they may be exposed to in the area. You have to review with each employee those parts of the fire prevention plan that they need for self-protection. OSHA has a great topic page dedicated to this. If you go to OSHA.gov, you can go to the A to Z index in the top right of the webpage. Click on that. Go to emergency action plans, emergency evacuation, or fire prevention. Any of those topics will get you this information. So I hope you got something out of this quick talk. This is something I'm passionate about. I was in fire prevention, early in my career and, over 20 years ago. But, this is something that's easy to do, right? But as many of you listening are probably scratching your head and nodding saying, yeah, but it's also easy to screw up. You just have to allow it to happen. Housekeeping is the biggest one. Just clutter, junk laying around, not maintaining your aisles. Look, OSHA doesn't require per se that you mark certain aisles, but I'm telling you, once you mark them, you're required to maintain them. And I always recommend that you mark your aisles because it's a visual barrier. It's visual, and you can see things sticking out like a sore thumb. You can say, that skid is over the line. We need to move that back. Those barrels shouldn't be sitting here. This is an aisle. A neat, orderly, well-maintained, well-marked and maintained workplace is going to get you a lot of mileage along the way of making sure you stay in compliance with the fire prevention program, emergency exit routes and access to the exit routes, all that good stuff. Okay, so go out, look at your workplaces, start writing this stuff down. Identify those opportunities you have to improve or, outright fix and correct compliance issues. Again, I hope you got some information out of this. Let me know what you think. Shoot me an email, info@thesafetypropodcast.com, or just go to thesafetypropodcast.com. Drop me a line right there. You'll notice the menu buttons up at the top. You can go to the podcast page for this episode and leave a message or reach out to me there as well. So that wraps it up. I tried to keep it a little brief on this episode covering, emergency exit routes and all things emergency action plan and fire prevention in a nutshell. So until the next Safety Pro podcast episode, as always, be safe.